And finally, this week saw the beginning of the United States bishops' ad limina visit to Rome, the first in 7 years. With over 300 bishops, the USCCB is one of the largest conferences in the Universal Church, and the ad limina visit will be phased over the next year. The first region to travel to Rome this week was from northeastern United States, with Hartford bishops meeting yesterday with Pope Benedict XVI. Among them, Bishop Thomas Tobin of Providence, Rhode Island, home to a 60% Catholic population. He spoke to us about the challenges and changes that have arisen since the last ad limina.
Firstly, if you wouldn't mind, Bishop Tobin, please just taking us through how this ad limina is being broken down, because you are a very big conference, so you can't possibly all come together.
Correct. In the bishops' conference, the bishops of the United States, we're about 300 altogether, so it would be impossible for all the bishops to travel at once and to do everything we need to do while we are visiting in Rome. The United States Bishops' Conference is divided into 14 sections, and we are the first section that is participating in the ad limina visit this year. And then there are several other regions that are visiting before the end of the year, and then the rest will begin right after the beginning of the new year. So it's a very long process involving 14 regions from the United States, and we are the first one. So people, I suppose, are watching us very closely to see what comes out of this first ad limina visits. I think the other bishops of the United States are very interested in what we will report from our week here in Rome.
For those of our listeners who perhaps aren't very familiar with what an ad limina visit is, or how an ad limina visit, or should we actually say pilgrimage, takes place, can you just briefly run through with them, with us, exactly what it is?
The ad limina visit is a wonderful opportunity that has several different dimensions. It is, first of all, a very spiritual pilgrimage, as you suggest. It is an opportunity for us to visit to the major basilicas, especially the tombs of the apostles, and that's what ad limina itself means. We come to the threshold of the apostles. That's what ad limina means, to the threshold of the apostles, especially Peter and Paul. And we come to pray in those beautiful basilicas and to reflect upon our own role as successors of the apostles and to renew our own commitment to Christ and to the church universal and in our own dioceses. So, first of all, it has a very spiritual element. One of the highlights, of course, is our opportunity to meet personally with the Holy Father, Pope Benedict, which is always a wonderful opportunity and a great privilege, a real blessing for us. And we've just recently had our meeting with the Holy Father, and it was a wonderful opportunity for all of us that we enjoyed and we're very grateful for. Then there's also an administrative side to the ad limina visits as well, because we visit many of the dicasteries, many of the congregations and offices of the Vatican. We have a chance to report on the work in our diocese and to ask them questions, and the officials of the Vatican also have a chance to ask us questions about the state of the church in the United States. All of this has been prepared for by the preparation of and sending of our quinquennial reports, which is the state of the union, the state of our church, which every bishop is required to prepare, typically 5 years, but in this case 7 years. It's a very large, very comprehensive report that reflects upon the state of the church in our own diocese. And that is sent to the office of the Vatican. They have a chance to review it to prepare for our visit ahead of time. So the ad limina visit has all those dimensions. It's a personal opportunity for the bishops to renew our own faith and our own commitment. It's an opportunity to pray at the tombs of the apostles, the great basilicas of Rome. It's an opportunity to meet with the Holy Father and to express to him our prayerful support and to receive from him direction and support, and has that administrative side as well, to report on the state of our own diocesan churches.
This is the first ad limina visit in 7 years, which basically means your last ad limina visit was with Blessed Pope John Paul II. This is your first ad limina visit with Benedict XVI. You met him on Saturday. Your impressions of that meeting?
Well, first of all, let me add to what you said. It is 7 years since we last traveled for the American bishops. Other bishops, of course, have been here in the intervening years, but for the American bishops, it is 7 years. So we were here in the year 2004, which is the last full year before our Holy Father, Blessed John Paul II, passed away. But this is our first opportunity to meet with Pope Benedict. And I suppose it's has been 7 years because it's just a very, very busy schedule and the change in the papacy and the changes have taken place. But we met with the Holy Father yesterday, and it was a wonderful opportunity. The Holy Father met with the bishops in a small group. In our case, just the bishops from the province of Hartford. So there were only 6 or 7 bishops present with the Holy Father. An opportunity, first of all, to take some nice photos with the Holy Father, but then to have a beautiful little discussion with him for almost a half hour, I would say, in which the Holy Father was very anxious to hear about particular questions or particular issues that each one of us bishops were addressing in our own dioceses. And he responded to each point we made. He was extraordinarily interested in and extraordinarily alert to what we were saying and to the suggestions we made. So it was a beautiful opportunity. I think every bishop came out of our meeting with the Holy Father very moved and very impressed.
Looking at the Diocese of Providence in the 7 years that have lapsed since the last time you were over here in Rome, what has changed in the last 7 years? What challenges is the diocese facing that perhaps it wasn't facing before? And perhaps what fruit has been borne in the last 7 years?
First, a little background might be helpful. The Diocese of Providence is in the state of Rhode Island, which some of our listeners might know that the state of Rhode Island is the smallest state in the United States. But statistically, the Diocese of Providence that covers the whole state of Rhode Island is the most Catholic state in the Union. Statistically, our population is about 60% Catholic. That's because of the large number of immigrants who have come to our state over the years and continue to come to our state today. They come from Catholic countries. So it is a small state, but it is intensely Catholic, with many, many parishes and schools and organizations and institutions. It's a beautiful place in which to be a bishop. But we are not immune from all the challenges that the church around the world and in the United States has faced in a very particular way. And I suppose the challenges we face can fall into several categories. First of all, we live in a very secular world, a world that is very secular, sometimes atheistic, almost pagan. And the church finds itself, even though we have large numbers of Catholics, sometimes we find ourselves, from a political point of view, being in a very difficult situation. So responding to those challenges, the moral, the political, the social challenges in which the church finds itself, is a constant work for us. Another area that's of constant concern is the sacramental practice of the faithful. Our faithful people, who are good people, still many have drifted away from the church for a variety of reasons. But the sacramental practice of our Catholics continues to be a great concern. Fewer people are attending Sunday Mass than did a generation or two generations ago. The whole question of the sacrament of holy matrimony is being challenged on many different fronts. And matrimony, of course, is the basis of family, is a serious concern for us. The viability of our Catholic schools is important. As you know, we receive no state funding for our schools, so the question of enrollment and financial viability of our schools and some of our parishes continues to be a major concern. Working with young people in our schools and campus ministry, that's a constant work for us as well. So all of these things come together to form challenges for us that are not unique to the Church of the United States and certainly not unique to the Diocese of Providence, but very real and pressing challenges nonetheless.
If I'm not mistaken, the Diocese of Providence, which, as you said, is within Rhode Island, one of the most Catholic states in the United States, is not alien to the, shall we say, the problem of secularization and the falling away of many faithful from the Catholic Church. To combat this phenomenon, particularly in Western countries, in the Western world, Pope Benedict XVI set up a new council, the Council for New Evangelization. Not only that, he decided that the next General Synod of Bishops will be dedicated to the theme of new evangelization. But many ordinary Catholics still don't understand what all this means. I mean, is it just another laboratory of words? What is new evangelization? How do you see it and perceive it? And how do you put it into action within your own diocese?
In some ways, and I'm very happy and very proud to say this, the Diocese of Providence has already begun this work. In the year 2010, in our own diocese, we proclaimed a year of evangelization, which had several emphases. First of all, we wanted to increase the presence of the church in the public life, in our community, in our society, which we did in many, I think, very effective ways. We also made a special effort to reach out to those Catholics who were lapsed Catholics, inactive Catholics, those who have stopped coming to church, as we said, for many different reasons, we made a very particular and determined effort to reach out to those fallen away Catholics and invite them back to our church.
How? I don't mean to interrupt you, but can you give me a practical example about how you actually do that?
Well, we did that. Our work was based mostly from a parish point of view. So we asked every parish to do something, and every parish did perhaps their own thing. They did different things. Some, very simple, was putting out a welcoming banner that the public could see outside of their church. Some had a series of catechetical issues or programs, either in their parish Sunday bulletins or in the particular classes they would hold. Some had beautiful ceremonies of reconciliation or listening sessions, inviting people to come back and just to share their concerns and their disappointments with the church. Some of our parishes worked through our Catholic schools, trying to engage the parents more in the life of the church. We used lots of media opportunities with advertisements on the radio and newspaper and television. So it was a multifaceted effort to make the church more present and to reach out to lapsed Catholics and to speak to those who had no church home at all, the unchurched, those who had never been Catholic, invited them to come and see. So that was our year of evangelization in the year 2010. So I was thrilled when the Holy Father has placed this emphasis now on the new evangelization and especially his gift of the proclamation of the year of faith. And I was able to say with a great deal of pride to the Holy Father yesterday that that would be a great gift to our own diocesan church, the year of faith, because it will build upon what we've already tried to do in the Diocese of Providence. So the sense of new evangelization, as Pope John Paul II said, the content is not new, but there needs to be a new emphasis and a new excitement and new enthusiasm for the beauty of our Catholic faith and our desire to share that faith with others.
Would you agree with the thought that it's an idea of coming out of the sacristy, going back out onto the streets?
That's one very good image. Yes, the church isn't, of course, just for ourselves, but the church by nature is constituted to evangelize, to share that good news with others. And it does take on very tangible, very practical forms. And that's where I think the application of the new evangelization, the application of the year of faith, will take hold in our local dioceses and even our local parishes. It might mean different things for different places, but it will touch the people and hopefully bring them back to the Lord and back to the church.
One of the key issues of this new evangelization has also been reaching out to lapsed Catholics. In general, from any of the information you have from speaking with your collaborators within the diocese, why do these people stop going to church? I know that it'll be a very general question, but what are the issues that they seem to pinpoint as being the reasons why they distance themselves from the community of Christ?
There are probably as many reasons why people stop coming to church almost as there are people themselves. Sometimes it is extremely personal. I think it's a well-known fact that some Catholics have stopped coming to church because they have been disillusioned by the scandals and the disappointments within the life of the church itself. Some people have been hurt by that and have been scandalized. Some people have stopped coming to church simply because of the societal context in which we find ourselves. We do live in a very secular age where God is marginalized. God is not at the center of our life. And the practice of faith has become an occasional thing rather than a daily, regular activity. Pope John Paul II spoke about the practical and existential atheism of our age. He said people no longer bother to deny the existence of God. They simply live their lives without him. A practical atheism. So I think people have been caught up in that too, that God has been marginalized and the practice of the faith is not very important. Some people have struggled with their own personal moral issues or moral crises that drive them away from the church, or at least they think. And some people have just become so busy, and sometimes, frankly, people are just too lazy to go to church on Sunday. They get so busy and so active, they don't set that time aside for God. So there are many different reasons why people have drifted away from the church. But putting the reasons aside, we want people to feel welcome. We want them to come home. And if they don't come to church, we don't want it to be our fault. We want to be able to say in honesty and in good conscience that we have done our very best to reach out to people and to be a welcoming community, to do our best to open the doors the doors of the church and the doors of Christ.
I don't think it can be denied that also one of the reasons why many Catholics who've been baptized have fallen away from the church has also been a very weak formation in the faith. Faith formation has also been one of the pillars of Pope Benedict XVI's pontificate so far. He has constantly emphasized the need for greater emphasis on Catholic education. This month, even though it's not directly linked to this issue, but in some way it is, we see the rolling out of the new English translation of the Missal. Has this been an opportunity to try and refamiliarize Catholics with the Missal, with their faith? And how has it been going so far in Providence? We know worldwide it has been welcomed by some, and by others there has been a certain reticence, if not outright almost anger at this new translation. But in your own diocese, how have you been trying to introduce this new translation among the Catholic people of your diocese?
Of course, for Catholics, nothing is more important than the celebration of the liturgy, the celebration of the Holy Mass. So any time there are changes in the liturgy, in the Mass, it is an issue that affects people very deeply and sometimes, as you say, very emotionally. We've been involved in our diocese in a long process now that has lasted almost a year, I suppose, of preparing people for the changes in the Roman Missal. Again, through classes and through information in our diocesan newspaper and websites, through seminars for almost every segment of the church, beginning, of course, with the priests, because the changes in the Missal will have as more effect on the prayer of the priest, perhaps even more so than the faithful in the pews. But beginning with the priests and deacons, religious educators, school teachers, parish ministers, youth ministers, and all the faithful, we've tried to reach them, and the process is not quite finished yet, even though we have only a few weeks. But it's an ongoing process of trying to remind people that the changes are coming, to explain why the changes are taking place, and to alert them to it, so when they do come to Mass after the changes, they will be well prepared for it. It will mean some challenge, I think, for Catholics and perhaps some inconvenience, but it's also a blessed opportunity for us to think about what we pray, to think about what we say. Our familiarity with the text of the Mass over 30 years or so, I think, has also led to a certain complacency about the prayers of the Mass. And that's a very human factor. But the use of new words, a new language, will give us an opportunity to think about what we are saying and what those words mean. So even though the words themselves will be changing, it's also a great catechetical opportunity for us to think about and what we're saying and praying, and perhaps renew our own understanding of the liturgy and what takes place at Holy Mass. So it is a two-edged sword. There will be moments of challenge, and as I've often said in my diocese, we need to keep a lot of patience and even a sense of humor about some of the things that will be happening, and to do so with good grace. But it's also an opportunity for us to renew our commitment to the liturgy and all that it means for us. The liturgy is the heart and soul of our Catholic faith. It's the source and the summit of everything we do. So it's important we celebrate the Mass as beautifully and as prayerfully as possible.
Very simply, why change the English translation of the Roman Missal?
Well, as has been pointed out, the translation we've been using for two generations now, I suppose, was never meant to be permanent. It was meant to be a temporary translation until a better translation could be developed. And it has taken many, many years. This did not come about overnight. But even in the American Bishops' Conference, this was a result of a great deal of study and consultation. The reasons, I think, are to make the English language, and it's not just for the United States, it's for other countries, of course, as well, but to make the English language more in conformity with the Latin text so that there would be that sense of unity and uniformity in the celebration of the liturgy, to make the English more consistent with the Latin text, but also hopefully to raise the level of our language. Sometimes the previous translations have been rather pedestrian, very common. I think some of the new translations are a little bit more inspired, a little bit more exalted, to remind ourselves that our prayer, our language of the liturgy should be different than our everyday common language. So I think they are the two basic reasons why we've embarked upon this very challenging and long consultation, changing the prayers of the Mass.
What are the main changes that the faithful can expect when they take a position in the pews in the church, preparing to celebrate the Eucharistic sacrifice as of the first Sunday of Advent.
Well, some of the prayers, of course, will not be changed. So I don't want people to be alarmed to think it's going to be completely different. The Mass itself remains the same, and many of the prayers will be very, very comfortable and familiar with people. But some of the specific changes they will encounter, for example, when the priest says, "The Lord be with you," the response will no longer be, "And also with you." Now the new response will be, "And with your spirit." I think that is going to be one of the most tangible and obvious changes, but other changes as well in the text of the Gloria, for example, and the profession of faith, and some of the other dialogues that take place during the Mass. The people will notice those changes immediately, because if they use their previous translation, they will be out of touch with what everyone else is saying. So some of those dialogues change a great deal. As I mentioned before, the changes will affect the priest even more, because the missal, the sacramentary, is changed. There are different layouts and different tabs and different texts, and so the priest will have to get used to the new missal as well. So we too, as priests and bishops, will have to practice, I think, a little bit with the new missal so that it becomes comfortable for us.
Everyone learning together, basically.
Yes, and that's why I think this process of perspective and patience and even sense of humor, I think, is terribly important. We'll be fine. It will take some time for us to get used to it, but if we can approach it that way and see the new translations as a gift, as an opportunity, I think we'll get through this very well, and we'll be fine, and in a year or so, perhaps we'll wonder what all the fuss was about.
2012 was also the presidential election in the United States of America, and I know that the United States bishops have rolled out their faithful citizenship website and indeed document, which is encouraging the electorate in the United States to think about certain key issues that the bishops deem to be the most important when one is considering a candidate to lead the United States of America, the world's most powerful economy and the world, one of the world's most powerful nations. Can you speak to us a little bit about this faithful citizenship document? What are the issues that the bishops feel are key that need to be addressed?
That's a great topic and very interesting. And the bishops have, every 4 years before a presidential election, the American bishops have produced this document called Faithful Citizenship. And we have reproduced that once again this year. We have added an introductory comment to explain what the document is about and how it should be used and how it should not be used. The bishops have tried very, very hard to avoid partisan politics. It doesn't matter a whole lot whether a candidate is a Democrat, Republican, or independent, or any other party. We try very hard to avoid partisan politics, and we try to avoid focusing on any one specific issue, even though there is certainly a hierarchy of issues. Some are more important than others, I suppose. But what we've tried to do is to encourage the voters, those of our own flock, Catholics, first of all, to be well-educated, to know about the candidates, to know what the issues are, to understand the issues, to be well-educated, and to be informed when they walk into their voting place, their voting booth, to cast their ballot, to be well-informed about the candidates, about the issues, and to take their faith with them into their voting place. We cannot separate our faith from the electoral process. Again, we don't care too much about partisan politics or any single issue to the detriment of others, but we try to encourage the faithful Catholics that they are well-informed and well-educated, and let their conscience then, an informed conscience, an educated conscience, be their guide. Faith has to have an impact on politics, has an impact on every other aspect of our life. As I've often said to my people, you cannot be a Catholic on a Sunday and a pagan the rest of the week. So faith does have a legitimate place in the partisan, in the political world. And I think that's what the American bishops have tried to encourage our faithful to do.
There was also a document recently about the defense of religious liberty, religious freedom within the public square that was released that got an awful lot of attention by the United States bishops. Is this again the importance of underlying that all faiths have a place and a role in society? And, you know, United States is very particular in this. It's one of the few countries that seems to have really managed to get it right, whereas religious issues can often divide societies. In the United States, it seems, you have a better approach to it. So can you talk to us briefly about that document?
Well, that concern about religious liberty, religious freedom, is a growing concern among the bishops of the United States. And the conference has just appointed a special committee to look into that and to defend religious liberty, because in many ways it is being challenged, in some ways that are very obvious and some ways that are more subtle. Religious liberty for Catholics and others, again, we go back to that theme of living in a very secular, atheistic society that does tend to discount and disregard religious values and practice. So the bishops are very concerned about that question of religious freedom and liberty that's being challenged, and we're trying to be very vigilant about that. Again, our goal is not to impose our own particular doctrine or our own faith on the whole of society, but to be sure that our society and our government respects the legitimate and deeply held moral values and faith values of Catholics and others. We believe that God has a place in our society. We believe that faith has enormous contributions to make to the well-being of our culture and our society. And to disregard those takes us in a very difficult and sometimes dangerous direction. So I think the American bishops are just trying to make those points, that God has a place in our world and that faith has a place in our society, and that our political establishment should not be in a position of demeaning faith or disregarding faith or even preventing people of goodwill of faith from practicing their own religious tenets. So it's an ongoing struggle, an ongoing battle, and be very interesting to see how it plays out in the days to come.
Bishop Tobin from Providence in New England, United States, thank you very much for speaking to us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure for me to be with you.